to another edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. As usual, I'm your host, and everybody knows who I am, so I'm not going to tell you again. We've done 51 episodes by now, you ought to know. And if you're not sure who I am, well, listen closely to the interview today, and eventually you'll figure out my name. And but if you really want to know now, you can go to the website at confessingourhope.com, and there you'll see who I am. That was all a joke, of course. But today is November 22nd, 2013, and this is broadcast number 51. And as I was talking off air with our guest, who we'll be speaking with in a few minutes, today is a significant day in American history, at least it's significant to me. As I was making notes about this podcast this morning, I actually wrote down I started to write down 1963. Now, maybe you think I'm loony. Perhaps I am. That may be beside the point. But it's interesting that today is the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. And many of my listeners are probably weren't alive during that time, I suspect. I wasn't. But it's been sort of an intrigue of mine for many years. And so I thought I'd mention that. It was a sad day in American history. But anyway, so we're doing this podcast number 51 on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. So I don't know if that means anything or not, but anyway, today we'll be talking with Ben Coppers. He's a pastor of an RCA congregation in Lansing, Illinois. We'll be talking with him about the denomination. Maybe you listen to this podcast on a regular basis and you don't know much about the RCA, and that's possible. But after today, you should have a better understanding of the work of the RCA, what they're doing, what are some of the key issues, key players, key concerns, that kind of stuff. And we'll be getting to that in just a minute. As usual, if you want to find out more about Greenville Seminary, you can do that on the web at gpts.edu. In addition to that, we do have a mobile app that you can take advantage of. I say this every week, but you can use the GPTS mobile app. You can get it for both your Android and iOS device. And it is very helpful, useful tool, so that if you're stranded in an airport somewhere or waiting in line, whatever the case may be, you can listen to this podcast as well as chapel sermons, theological conferences, whatnot. There's a bunch of information, bunch of resources packed into this mobile app, and of course it is free for your use. So take advantage of that. We've had quite a few people get it to date, and so if you don't have it, go ahead and get it. It's information's on the website for you to take advantage of. In addition to that, we do want you to avail yourself of the recent segment that we've been doing, the special segments that we've been running monthly with Dr. Piper, the president of the seminary. We call it Faith in Practice. It's an opportunity for you, the listener, to send your questions to us, and you run the program. You send your theological question, your practical question, whatever it may be, to us, and we will read your question on the air, and Dr. Joseph Piper will answer it for you, live and in color, as it were. And if you do get your question read on the air, I will send you a free copy of a book of your choice that is listed on the website. So take advantage of that. Again, that information is on the confessingourhope.com website for your use. Now, as I mentioned, we'll be speaking with Pastor Ben Coppers today about the RCA, its beginnings. What does it even stand for? You might be thinking, well, RCA, that's a TV company, isn't it? Well, no, it is, but that's not what we're going to be talking about in today's discussion. So, Pastor Coppers, it's good to have you on. And as we talked off air, you're in Lansing, Illinois, and thankfully you were not in that region where those storms came through. And so thankful to the Lord for your safety and that. But thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk with me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Bill.
Tell us, Pastor Coppers, as I mentioned already, the RCA. It's not a TV company. What does RCA stand for?
Yeah, RCA stands for the Reformed Church in America. And
okay.
We'll talk about what it is, I guess, so fire away.
Absolutely. Right, sure. Now, what kind of history does the RCA have? Obviously, Reformed Church in America, does the RCA have any presence outside the country?
Yeah, it does. The RCA has a pretty significant presence in Canada, and so largely we're a Reformed Church in America, meaning North America, not just the United States of America, and a missionary presence throughout the world. perhaps decreasing over time, but we've been a very mission-involved denomination over the many centuries that we've been around.
Great. And how did the denomination come into existence?
Yeah, well, it's a rather unique beginning in a way. As you may or may not recall from history, New York was actually originally settled by Dutch settlers and led by a guy named Peter Stuyvesant. Well, these Dutch settlers brought with them their Dutch Reformed faith, and so although they weren't leaving for the United States or for America for religious reasons, yet they still brought their faith with them and formed a church. And so in 1628, Dutch merchants, about 50 of them, gathered together in what would one day be New York City and celebrated a worship service and the Sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And so, for almost 400 years now, the RCA has been worshiping continuously on the continent of North America.
Great. So the denomination that you said is 400 years old.
Nearly 400 years old. I believe it's the oldest. It's the oldest Protestant denomination continually functioning in North America.
Yeah, I was going to say. I was thinking myself when you mentioned that. I thought, you know, I used to think the ARP, the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, was the oldest. But boy, that's not even close.
Yeah,
you know, it's 400 years. That's 10 generations of people.
That's right.
If you take 40 years, right, as a generation, that's quite a long time. Now, Dutch Reformed background, how does that play into some of its theological distinctives? Confession of faith.
It very much plays in confessionally, primarily. Your listeners will be familiar with the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Westminster Catechisms. But the Dutch Reformed tradition uses different confessions, very similar. But we use the Heidelberg Catechism and the Belgic Confession and the Canons of Dort as our confessional standards. And so we come from the Continental Reformed tradition, whereas separate from the British Reformation or whatnot, or the Westminsterian tradition. And so, they're very similar in a lot of ways, yet the flair is different within the confessions, and that marks, I think, a bit of the theological distinction of the Dutch Reformed churches.
Hmm. Now, when you say the Heidelberg Catechism, the Belgic Confession, and the Synod of Dort, is that the three forms of unity?
That would be the three forms of unity. That's correct.
Okay. Just clarify that for the listeners so that they understand. If we mention the three forms of unity in the future in this discussion, you understand that we're talking about these three particular items as their doctrinal standards. The PCA, of course, has the Westminster Confession of Faith as their secondary standard. You know, make sure we say that, secondary standard. And other denominations hold to the Westminster Confession of Faith, but the Dutch Reformed pull theirs from the three forms of unity, the Heidelberg Catechism, the Belgic Confession, and the Synod of Dort. And so that's just helpful to know that up front. Now, what are recently you had your General Synod in June of this year. Mm-hmm. And what do you, in your opinion, of course, think the health of the RCA is at this particular time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say the RCA is not well. We're not in a good spot, particularly so after this previous General Synod. You can ask elaborating questions on that for a number of reasons. I would say the RCA is not a healthy denomination.
Okay. Certainly in American, we talked briefly about this off air a little bit. American evangelicalism sort of changed faces a lot over the last even recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly touched both Presbyterian and Reformed circumstances and situations across the country.
Right.
You got the issues of homosexuality working its way into the church. You've got other matters that are being grossly misunderstood, misrepresented, whatever the case may be. What are some of those theological concerns that you of course, now, just so people understand, when I ask these kinds of questions, these are your opinions. These are not de facto statements of the denomination.
Absolutely. Right.
But your impressions of what you see going on What are some of those theological concerns, perhaps? We'll maybe start with those and then maybe move to some methodological issues as well.
Sure. Well, I guess there's really a root cause of my concerns, and the root cause of my concerns is biblical authority. I would confess an inerrant word, not just infallible, not just authoritative, but inerrant and fully accurate. And that's not the official position of the Reformed Church in America. And so what you end up having is very different understandings of what biblical authority means, very different hermeneutics as to how to understand what Scripture teaches on issues like justice, on issues like human sexuality, and issues like gender and biblical manhood and womanhood. And so those three issues, I think, would become the theological concerns that most, I would say, evangelicals or conservative evangelicals in the Reformed Church would have. And those issues surface in a number of ways. The issue of justice surfaced recently with the introduction of the Belhar Confession as a fourth standard or a fourth confession of the Reformed Church. The Belhar Confession was a document written in South Africa to deal with apartheid, very helpful in a lot of ways, and yet makes some statements that that leave us wondering if we can really use it as a confession, speaking of all separation as being sinful. Of course, we recall in the words that Paul instructs us to separate from the immoral brother, to expel the immoral brother. Does the Belhar Confession exclude church discipline? Is it clear enough in those matters to be able to be used as a confession? Also speaks of things like God is in a special way the God of the poor, and can that be justified with the fact that, you know, the Lord was the one who chose Abraham, who was extremely wealthy, and Job, who was extremely wealthy, and David and Solomon, who were extremely wealthy. And so how do you understand statements like that against the testimony of Scripture? So the Belhar Confession, arising out of a desire to embrace maybe more of a social agenda on justice, although I don't mean to say that justice or social agendas are entirely wrong. It depends on how you interpret them. The Belhar Confession arose largely out of the left wing of the RCA and then was formally adopted as a fourth confession in the church. And then
before you leave that point, let me ask a question, because as I was preparing for this discussion today, I was on the website and I noticed that under your doctrinal standards, it's funny how seminary students tend to gravitate towards these things, right? You get on the website, like, what's your doctrinal position, right? And clicking away, trying to figure it out. And, you know, I recognized the three forms of unity right away. And then I saw this, how did you pronounce the
Belhar Confession? Yep.
Yeah, and I saw that and I thought, what is it? I've never heard of that. I've been Reformed since 1995. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of anything like that in my life. Mm-hmm. I thought this is going to be interesting, and then you brought it up, and I'm glad you did. How does that then relate to the three forms of unity? Is there any conflict between them, or is it a separate thing altogether?
Is there conflict between them? It depends on who's interpreting the Belhar Confession as to whether they feel there's conflict between them. I was opposed to the adoption of the Belhar Confession as a standard in the Reformed Church in America. I wasn't opposed to it because I disagree with its heart. I think that the heart of it is right, especially dealing with apartheid in South Africa, where the separation of people, specifically the separation of Christian brothers, based on race. Of course, that should be rejected. So I agree with much of the heart of it, but it is not specific in a way that traditional Reformed confessions have been, whether you're speaking of the Heidelberg Catechism or the Westminster Confession. There's a degree of precision among our confessions, precisely laying out what exactly is being taught, what exactly we understand the word to be teaching. The Belhar Confession is not that at all. It's much more vague. It leaves things very open-ended, so that it can be widely interpreted in different ways. And in fact, the author, the original author of the Belhar Confession, a man named Alan Bozak, interprets and intends for the Belhar Confession to be interpreted in a way that would include homosexuality among acceptable practices in the church. And not only that, but homosexual practicers, that is those who are practicing on their homosexual desires, would be fully included in the life of the church. Well, even his own denomination did not agree with his interpretation of the document that he wrote, that they accepted. And so you see that there's a level of ambiguity with the Belhar Confession that just isn't there with the other confessions that we have. And so really whether there's a disagreement between the other three and the Belhar Confession, it really truly does depend on who's reading the Belhar Confession and how they already understand the other three confessions that we hold to.
Right. I'm looking at it, in fact, right now, a little more closely than I did previously. And for the listener's sake, I'm going to put a link to it on the website so that when people are listening to this broadcast, they can reflect on it or look back at it and say, okay, I see what he's talking about. And it's just interesting to me that a denomination with such history, 400 years, holding to the three forms of unity, which has a long-standing historical basis, has been adopted by not just the RCA but other Reformed Presbyterian denominations. I probably shouldn't say Presbyterian, but regardless,
I believe that it is in the PCUSA's Book of Confessions now. So I think
I think you're right.
You could say Presbyterian and.
Okay.
Yeah, if you can want to hang an asterisk on that or something, you can do that.
Sure. But, yeah, there's the verbal asterisks there included. But it's just interesting to me that to have this historic stance on the three forms of unity that a denomination that has such a history as the RCA would need to run to another confession to try to isolate some of these issues without creating what you've just described as some of these ambiguities or interpretive questions that are difficult to answer and tend to divide, even though what it's trying to do is unite. And it's just interesting to me that would even have to happen given the history of the denomination. But it's sad to see that. Now, you mentioned other issues at the last synod. What were some of those?
Right. Well, since about 1980, the Reformed Church has lived in a tension in regards to women's ordination. The first one was ordained in the 1970s by a classis, that's like a presbytery, by a classis in the East. I mean New York or New Jersey, that area, against the official position of the Reformed Church in America. However, through the judicial process, her ordination was upheld. And so they created this tension where at that time, the majority of the Reformed Church would have been of a complementarian persuasion, and the minority would have been in favor of women's ordination. But complementarians felt as though they were somewhat vulnerable, as now the rules had changed. The women were permitted to be ordained to the office of elder, deacon, and what we call minister of word and sacrament, just like a teaching elder. And so what was created, and some of my friends were involved in the authoring of this, was something called the conscience clauses. It permitted men and who were serving in office who objected on the grounds of biblical interpretation and conscience to the ordination of women to serve without any threat of recrimination or any threat of having to go against their conscience. It also prohibited those men from being able to unlawfully hinder the ordination of a woman to office. So it basically said, as long as you're not going to go out of your way to go against the heart of what the denomination believes regarding women's ordination, you're allowed to stay here and live in peace, and we're not going to come after you. So those were brought in the early 80s, those conscience clauses, and so we lived in this tension for about 30 years, where there were complementarians like myself within the Reformed Church who objected to women's ordination, but who would go to classes, and there would be women pastors and churches with women elders would be present, and so you just had this continual tension between the two sides. And over that time, of course, the position in favor of women's ordination became the dominant position, not only dominant, but nearly exclusive. I would say 90% or more of our pastors and churches would probably would probably express support for women's ordination in some form or fashion. Mm. And so complementarians found themselves in a more and more outside looking in sort of role, feeling less and less as though they were a part of things. And in fact, feeling as though their opportunity to serve on commissions and committees and to serve the denomination as a whole in any capacity was being limited, or perhaps just was non-existent. Well, then, a number of times there were attempts made to remove the conscience clauses from the Book of Church Order by egalitarians who felt that they were inappropriate, that we should be fully embracing women's ordination, and that it introduced confusion into the Reformed Church.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, in this last minute in 2013, they were successful in constitutionally removing the conscience clauses, which have offered protection for men like myself for quite some time. Now, the issue involved in the removal of the conscience clauses is not that I'm afraid of getting brought up on discipline any time now immediately, but the issue really has to do with ordination of those who have not yet been ordained to the office of minister of ordained sacrament. To be ordained in the RCA, you have to receive what's called a certificate of fitness for ministry from one of our two official seminaries, which are both, I guess I would say, militantly egalitarian, or the another certification agency which works outside of those seminaries, but the board of which is composed, usually the majority of the board is ordained women, and those who are not ordained women are themselves of egalitarian persuasion, oftentimes composing or comprised of professors from the other two seminaries. So without the constitutional protection of the conscience clauses, it really leaves complementarians in a vulnerable position, and you're seeing many of those men who would have come into the RCA opting not to even begin the ordination track now, because it's very uncertain if they'll be able to be ordained.
Yeah, that is, I don't want to use the word unfortunate, because that's not strong enough. It's just sad to see those kinds of things happening. Now, when you say that this was approved in this last General Synod, I mean, in the PCA, which is where I'm a ruling elder, when General Assembly makes a determination to change the Constitution, it's got to go through all the presbyteries.
That's right.
It's got to get two-thirds of the presbyteries before it becomes ratified. Is that something that still has to happen?
That's the same process that happens. And so the 2012 General Synod voted to propose that change to the classes. The vote went to the classes. It needed to get two-thirds of the classes. It got exactly two-thirds of the classes. And then, so that means that, you know, there wasn't a huge degree of consensus. Two-thirds is not all that much, and I can explain why it's even less impressive than it sounds.
Yes, do that.
Well, the RCA is composed of about 45 classes. And so a lot of those classes are historically drawn geographic regions. And so early on in the RCA's history, there were no cars, no automobiles of any kind. And so, you know, within the city of New York, within the greater New York region, you may have three, four, five, six different classes. And those classes may have anywhere from 600 to 1,500 members total in a classes. And so relatively small amounts of people per classes, whereas you come out west here to the Midwest a little bit, the classes I'm a member of, which is Ileana, Florida classes, has almost 10,000 members in the classes. And the classes of Zeeland, which is a very conservative classes, has over 10,000 members in it. But when the classes votes are counted, Ileana, Florida, and Zeeland each get one vote. And
right.
A number of classes who, if you can add up eight different classes out east, combine all their members, and they still have fewer members than Zeeland classes does.
Hmm.
So all those eastern classes voted for the removal of the conscience clause, whereas Zeeland and Ileana voted against it. And yet, you know, there were eight votes for the removal against the one vote for the retention. So it's a difficult situation when, you know, most likely the membership of the classes, if you just tallied it up, there's no way they would get to two-thirds membership of the classes. But that's not how the game is played.
Was this subject, as far as women ordination and then transferring it over to the removal of this conscience clause from your constitution, was it dealt with on an exegetical basis at all?
No.
I mean, was
at least it wasn't in the conversations around me that I was involved in. It's frequently dealt with in a, this is the RCA's official position. We don't debate this position anymore. Now we need to figure out how to implement this official position. Mm. When you attempt to inject exegetical conversation into the matter, you quickly become the bad guy in the room. And so much of the conversation that I was involved in, now perhaps this was different in other classes, mm-hmm. but much of the conversation that I was involved in was largely emotional appeals. So, perhaps a woman who's ordained stands up and says, the conscience clauses make me feel uncomfortable. They make me feel as though I'm not fully ordained as a male counterpart is, and so I think they should go. Now, whether there's merit to that or not is a conversation for a different day.
Yeah, it sounds highly pragmatic.
It was not, at least the conversations I was a part of, and I'm rather widely involved in conversation, at least, on these sorts of matters. The conversation was largely not exegetical, I'm not sure if it ever was or not.
Is there any recourse for, you mentioned some of the conservatives, the conservative classes, and certainly you've been in contact or talked with some of them, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. I know I would be if I were in that situation. Is there any recourse under your constitution to try to change that process, or are you pretty much stuck with it?
Well, we're pretty much stuck with it. Is there a way to change that? Yes, there is. It involves changing the Book of Church Order, which involves getting a two-thirds classes vote in your favor.
So you're right back where you started.
So the immovable object preventing all reform that would favor the evangelicals or the conservative reformed wing of the denomination is the two-thirds requirement in the Book of Church Order for the classes vote. Until the classes are restructured, which will never happen, until the classes are restructured, it will be impossible to make positive Book of Church Order or constitutional changes.
Well, let me ask this question. This is a practical question, and I'm trying to find the most sensitive way to ask this.
Go ahead.
Obviously, you're a minister of God's Word. Mm-hmm. You're a pastor of a rather large congregation, as you've mentioned to me off air. What do you do, and is there any risk to you as a minister when you deal with passages in the New Testament that absolutely debunk your own denomination's position?
Yeah. We are a congregation that's 152 years old, and we've been a congregation that has stood upon the Word, even and especially perhaps on matters of gender and sexuality and biblical manhood and womanhood. And so it's expected of me here that I will do exactly that.
Now, praise the Lord.
There is no recourse against me for preaching that way. I make it grief over it, but there's no recourse against me for preaching on the truth of the Word in regards to women's ordination and not only to our position, but to the historic position of the church and the majority position of the church universal even now. So there's no problem there. The problem would be that if I wasn't ordained, it was to come out that I would believe that. In essence, we're entering a waiting game where, with very few to no complementarians coming into the denomination, where's a church like mine going to find its next pastor?
Yeah, so if I could summarize, if I were to graduate from seminary and decide that I want to pursue a call in the RCA, and then they examine me and find out that I'm absolutely opposed to women's ordination, I would be pretty much bounced.
It really depends.
But there's a high likelihood of that anyway.
It's certainly a possibility, and you would, whereas before you could claim a constitutional protection, now you would be entirely you've been entirely dependent upon the good graces of the certification agencies,
which could be composed of women who are that have been ordained.
Will be composed of that, and the composition of which will change from year to year, and whose mood may change from interview to interview.
Right.
And so
sounds like a vicious cycle.
You know, you invest thousands of dollars and lots of time in taking courses and entering this program, and now your hope of coming out is no longer a constitutionally protected hope. Your hope of coming out is based upon the good graces of those who have very strong disagreements with your position. And that makes you very vulnerable.
Yes, and as I listen to you talk, I can hear in your, just in the way you're expressing it, the weight of it. I'm listening to it. I'm not in the RCA, and I feel bad for you given that situation. It's just got to be very difficult. All the more reason to pray for our brothers who are in these denominations that are in these circumstances. You know, us in the conservative world, of which I find myself very much embroiled, and I'm glad, embroiled, that's the wrong word, but I'm part of that, and, and strongly confessional, strongly inerrant, in the inerrant, infallible Word of God, and no apologies are ever going to come from my mouth on that subject. But, you know, it's easy for us on this side to look across the pond, as it were, and say, well, what's keeping you there?
That's a very good question.
And forget that there are men, such as yourself, and as you've indicated, other men in other congregations that are trying to labor where they find themselves and trying to deal with these matters in a God-honoring manner. Mm-hmm. And the reminder, I think, for all of us, listeners included, is that we need to be actively praying for men in these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm in the PCA. We've got our issues, but we don't have that issue.
No, you don't. And having been I attended a PCA church for a couple of years in Jackson when I went to RTS. And, you know, it was very much a breath of fresh air. But I got the question very often while I was there, why are you going to the RCA? Why are you going there? What would draw you there? And now, the RCA is a different place now than it was 3 years ago when I graduated. And with the removal of the conscience clause and things like that make it a very different environment. But, you know, there are good and faithful churches who have been in the RCA for a long time and who need good leadership. And there comes a point at which your conscience doesn't allow you to serve within a certain denomination anymore. And when that point comes, then you don't come into the RCA or you leave the RCA if that point comes. But until you get to that point, then for those of us who grew up within the Reformed Church of America, there was really a heart for ministering to those people who we shared common background with, who we shared in the struggle with. And so where that point of conscience comes is an issue for discussion. But that was really the reason. That was really the reason for embarking back into the RCA, because there are good, God fearing, Bible believing churches that need solid preaching of the Word.
Right. Did you grow up in an RCA?
Yes.
Context.
It's the only denomination I've ever been a member of. It's the only place I've ever been able to call home, as far as a denomination goes. My grandfather is a retired RCA minister. My great-grandfather was an RCA minister and church planner. And so I'm Dutch through and through, both sides. My history in the Reformed Church in both sides of my family goes back a significant ways. And so there's a heritage here that counts for something, not everything.
Yeah, this is a reminder for us as we think about our brothers laboring in these denominations to be praying actively for their work.
Right.
If you get nothing else from this entire discussion on this one little subject, well, I shouldn't say little, but one subject, that's what you get from it.
Yeah.
And to be praying for them. We spent a lot of time on that, so I'm going to rapidly move through some of these other aspects that the RCA is involved in. Church planting.
Yep. Yeah, the RCA is very involved in church planting. Trying to plant a very large number of churches in the next decade or so. And as with most church planting endeavors, meeting with mixed success. If there's a glimmer of hope in the Reformed Church, it's in the it's in the church planting. Church planters tend to be just more conservative on average than your average RCA church or average RCA pastor. So there's a lot of emphasis on the evangelical side in putting a lot of resources into the church planting and hoping to multiply.
And that'd be one way, really, kind of moving back to what we just talked about. If churches that were in the conservative situation that were opposed to what's going on planted churches and sort of were careful in that process, that would be one way to upset the balance.
Yeah, you have to plant churches in the classes that are unfavorable towards your position, which is very difficult.
Yep. To manage. You know, it's one thing that we talked a little bit about here in the PCA with some of the issues we're dealing with is, you know, we've got to change the balance a little bit, and I don't know how else to do it. You know, status quo is not going to accomplish it.
Right.
So you sort of work that out. You mentioned that, I think you said two seminaries.
Yes, that's right.
Where are those and what are they?
Yeah, we have Western Theological Seminary, which is located in Holland, Michigan, and New Brunswick Theological Seminary, which is located in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I believe it's actually on the campus of Rutgers University. New Brunswick Seminary is, and I'm sure they wouldn't even be upset to hear me describe them this way, they're a liberal seminary, very progressive seminary. Their previous president was actually tried in 2005 at General Synod because he performed a wedding for his daughter and her partner. And so... A very robustly pro-homosexual ordination bent in New Brunswick Seminary, but largely irrelevant outside of the eastern portion of the RCA. Much more relevant is Western Seminary, which is has more of an impact on the denomination as a whole. But there, too, one of the New Testament professors just wrote a book entitled Bible, Gender, and Sexuality, and the book was definitely coming from a pro-homosexual inclusion bent, and he has recently, you know, been making speeches about the book and presenting on the book,
and
even participating in events like Holland is Ready, which is a pro-homosexual acceptance sort of event in Holland, Michigan, where the seminary is, and so. You'll see an increasing level of boldness among the professors at Western Seminary, which would not have been there a number of years ago, on the issue of what they call full inclusion. And so the seminaries, for those of us who are evangelical and reformed and that sort of thing, the seminaries are just not educational options that are open to us at this point.
Just a propaganda machine.
Well, it certainly is not a place that you or I would feel very comfortable.
No, it doesn't sound like it. But it is interesting you have two. I know some Presbyterian Reformed denominations that don't have any.
Yeah, there's wisdom in not having any.
Right.
When there's more accountability, when the seminaries are written into your Book of Church Order, and when they're supported at least in part through assessment dollars, then there's just by nature less accountability than there would be if it was like an RTS system where the seminary is independent of the denominations and is only as fruitful as they permit it to be.
Yeah, well, it is... You know, it's interesting because as you're talking about the seminaries, I thought, well, I mean, who has oversight over these seminaries? I mean, they have a board of trustees, I'm assuming, but is that run by the denomination so that they have full control over what they do?
There is a board of trustees for the seminary, and the General Synod is to oversee some of the professors. But like most things in the RCA, rather conflicted in identity, rather conflicted in purpose and vision. And so, I from my perspective, very little true accountability. But
what is the attendance at these seminaries? I mean, it's attendance. What is the enrollment?
Yeah, you know, I'm not actually sure what the enrollment is. you get the pamphlets in the mail that speak of good enrollment numbers, but they're not going to tell you if it's bad. So I'm not actually sure if that'd be a good thing to.
Interesting to me if it was a high enrollment, then you can see where some of the problems are coming from and mm-hmm. why you're kind of moving in this direction or mm-hmm. have moved. If not, then you kind of ask those questions in a different place. You know, why is it? You know, what's feeding this liberal mindset in the denomination? Is it the seminary level? I'm sure at some level it probably is. But in other areas, what is feeding that? Well, we've talked about the negative things, and that's, for me, always easier.
Mm-hmm.
Just my personality, I think. But what are some positive things that you see coming out of the denomination?
Yeah, that's a more difficult question to answer. If we'd had this interview 6 months ago before General Synod, I would have told you about General Synod 2012, where through the course of events we were able to pass a resolution that states that officiating homosexual weddings or openly advocating for homosexual inclusion in the church are what we'd call the disappointable offense. That is just open to discipline at the class's level or discipline from a local elder board. But that declaration was rescinded at our past synod and actually repented of. So I would say at this point, it's difficult to find a silver lining in the direction of the Reformed Church in America. That's different than saying that there aren't a lot of good guys and a lot of solid churches. But at this point, as far as the direction of the denomination is concerned, it's difficult to find too many positive things to hang your hat on. And those things which may be positive, new staff members or new professors or this kind of thing, the jury's out on what maybe some of the more evangelical of the more evangelical leaning leaders of the denomination are going to be able to do, or even are going to be able to be willing to do. So I would say that right now we're facing a very difficult trajectory, a very daunting trajectory with a lot of big obstacles to reform, and I think the real possibility that the RCA just isn't going to be able to be called home for evangelicals or for people who are conservative and reformed.
Yeah, I'm thinking of one denomination in the Presbyterian world that at one time in its history was the bastion of Presbyterian thought, Reformed thought, and now I wouldn't get anywhere near.
Mm.
And it just seems to me that that's just the tendency of human nature to destroy that which is starts out great and ends up horrible. I don't know why that is. Well, I do know the reason, but anyway, that's another subject for another day. What, for context purposes, are there any men in your denomination that those of us who are not as acquainted with the RCA might know, just off, you know, household names?
Yeah, Kevin DeYoung is an RCA pastor and a friend of mine. We've worked together in renewal work and in many conversations about that sort of thing for quite a while. So he would definitely be the best known.
Didn't he write a book on pastoring?
Kevin DeYoung has written a number of books on pastoring.
Yeah, okay. Well, I definitely probably was right about that then.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say I've read one of his books, and I'm actually trying to put my hand on it as we're talking, in my home library, which is not as well. Anyway, I can't remember the name of it. Maybe you know.
Well, I'm trying to think of what maybe you're talking about. He wrote a book on the Heidelberg Catechism, which I highly recommend, called The Good News We Almost Forgot. And it's a survey of the Heidelberg Catechism. And I thought just a fantastic introduction to one of the very, I would say, the crown jewel of the Reformed confessional documents. And he's involved with Together for the Gospel and the Gospel Coalition. He blogs for the Gospel Coalition. So a lot of good resources that he writes that come out of our tradition. So I think Kevin would be the best known evangelical voice in the Reformed Church.
Sure. Well, we're getting close to the end, the time that I promised that I'd probably have you off. You know, I was going to, the next question I was going to ask you is how can the larger body be praying for the denomination? But I think we've covered that.
Yeah. Well, I would ask also that that there be prayer for those of us like myself who are increasingly finding ourselves at odds with the direction of the Reformed Church, that we'd have wisdom to know what the Lord is calling us to do, where He's calling us to be, and where He's calling us to go.
Yeah, and it's not just you. It's not just the ministers, and this is a point that I think a lot of people forget. You know, when you're talking, ask the question, you know, what's keeping you in the RCA or what's keeping you in wherever you may be, especially as a minister, it seems to me that that you're not just answering the question for yourself, but you're also talking about the hundreds of people or thousands of people, as the case may be, that you're also thinking about as well, your congregations and those men and women, those families that have been charged to you to minister to. You're really answering the question not just individually but also corporately, and there's a lot to think about there.
Yep, that's right.
As you indicated, you know, it's not just those people, but it's also the history and all the family relations and those kinds of aspects that are just sort of feed that mix and makes it all the more difficult, I think, at some level.
Certainly. And, you know, ministering in a context where what you're preaching from the pulpit on Sunday morning is different than what people may be reading on the denomination's website introduces confusion, introduces a degree of consternation, I think, into the people's thoughts and hearts. And so all those things add extra hurdles and extra challenges that brothers and sisters in the PCA or the OPC or the ARP or wherever may not necessarily be facing, at least not to the same degree.
No, there's no question. I mean, I'm in the, as you've heard me say already, I'm in the PCA. We've got our problems. I mean, I'm fond of mentioning them. But, you know, but not like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just tend to forget about our brothers who are laboring in places that are far worse situations than we find ourselves, and we bemoan what we see going on in our own denomination, and rightly so. But then we look across and we say, wow, man, we're not even close to that kind of a problem, at least not yet. I mean, I could see it happening. I hope it doesn't, but I could see it happening. And, you know, how would we react to that? And those of us who want to stand on the authority of Scripture and preach it faithfully and not waver from these kinds of what I call slippery slope type issues, it just brings me back to the reality that we have brothers who are laboring in very difficult circumstances, and we need to be praying for those churches, we need to be praying for those elders, and so forth, because it is difficult regardless of what people might think and say. And you mentioned the trajectory already. I was going to talk about, you know, what do you see happening in the future?
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, without beating a dead horse, you know, make it worse than it already is situation. But where do you see 10 years down the road, if you had to predict?
10 years down the road, if I had to predict, I predict a significantly smaller Reformed Church in America, significantly more liberal Reformed Church in America, and an increasingly broke Reformed Church in America that is largely devoid of major evangelical voices, and particularly of conservative evangelical voices. I think a lot of the moves the RCA has made in the last few years have been to homogenize and to intentionally shrink the church. And I think that when a number of the larger, more evangelical churches begin to see the writing on the wall, I think the Reformed Church in America could very well find itself in its final years if things don't change. I could be totally wrong, but my crystal ball, if you want to put it that way, says the RCA would be smaller, more liberal, and significantly less relevant, shall we say, in the scope of the American church 10 years from now.
Well, it's sad to hear that, and I'll confess openly, when I was thinking about this discussion today, I wasn't expecting to hear any of this. I admit that. And so I'm a little taken aback by, you know, where do I take the conversation and what do I even talk about?
Yeah, sure.
It just sounds, I mean, I can hear it in your tone of voice and understandably, especially as one who grew up in that denomination, you obviously have close relations there, close history. It's just hard. It's hard to see. In some sense, maybe I'm, unless I miss my, unless my guess is way off, in some sense it's like seeing a family member who just decides to just go and leave the family and do what they want and sort of depart from everything that they've ever known. In some sense, that's what it's like for you, because that's all you've known
it's,
your whole life.
Yeah, it's personal in a way that it wouldn't be if there wasn't so much history there. And having family members in the Reformed Church who would disagree with me on some of these issues. Really there's a sense of hurt that goes deeper than maybe it would in other situations. The RCA is a small denomination as well. 140,000 members or so. And so there's a way in which you see the same people, pop up here and here and here, and you really begin to know who's who and who fits where. Lots of relationships, and I've only been ordained for 3 years. Been involved in the RCA for a little bit longer than that, as far as, you know, meeting with people and going to synod,
sure,
sort of thing. But, you know, there's a sense of relational loss involved in a lot of this as well. And so that does certainly add to the mix. And there's a sense of hurt. But there's also a degree to which, as a minister of the word, you make your decisions based on what's best for Christ's church and what is going to allow for the gospel to be most faithfully and powerfully proclaimed, not only now but for years to come. And so, those are a lot of the conversations and decisions that many of us are facing now.
Yeah, well, it's a great reminder too, as what you just said, is that, you know, this is Christ's church. Left to ourselves, we would be a mess. We already are a mess, and we'd be much more of a mess than we already are.
That's right.
And thankfully, he is sovereign, and he is running his church. It is his. He is the king and head of it, and I'm just thankful to be a part of it in some small measure and to try to be faithful wherever I may find myself, as you are trying to be faithful there in Illinois. And, you know, my wife was born in Illinois, just as an aside. So it must be a great state, because that's
what I was. Well, actually, I live in Indiana because the taxes are a lot cheaper, so Illinois is not that great.
Okay, well, there you go. Wrong again. But anyway, well, it's still, Illinois is still a good state, if only because of the fact that my wife was born
there.
Fine.
There you go.
That much I know I'm right
there
about,
you go.
If that even makes any sense at all. Well, Pastor Coppers, it's been great, I mean, to talk with you. Not great to hear the report.
Mm-hmm.
In the way things are headed, but at least it's given me personally something to pray for you.
Sure.
I've never met you, and who knows if we ever will, maybe someday. But at least I know your name and your voice, and I know the circumstance you find yourself in, and I will be praying for the RCA, for your ministry, that the Lord would protect you from any pushback, from you trying to be faithful to the scriptures and preach these matters, especially when they come up. And that you would persevere, and I know it's difficult when you feel like everything's against you, you feel like you're the odd man out, but I will be praying for that. And I encourage the listeners to be praying for these denominations, not just the RCA, but definitely them, that find themselves in these circumstances, that there's more people in those circumstances than people realize. And pray that the Lord would keep them faithful to these things and not give in to what is often Satan often uses with men that minister the word, that the pressure of their peers can be huge. And so you pray that God would protect them from that, because as I mentioned just recently in a sermon I was preaching, men don't stand in the pulpit week after week to entertain people. They're standing there as the mouthpiece of God preaching his word, and it's not always popular. And so you pray for these men, especially in unfriendly circumstances, because that's what this is. And you pray that God would cause them to persevere and work and be effective and minister where they are. It sounds like your congregation is really flourishing and thankful to the Lord for that as well. Now, any further comments?
No, I just want to thank you for having me on today, and
I hope you don't get any pushback from your discussion with me.
No, it'll be fine. And nothing I said here I wouldn't be able to say somewhere else and haven't at some point in time said somewhere else publicly. So
right.
There's no secret. There's a lot of tension with the Reformed Church, and we just touched on it today a little bit.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know how much more I would want to touch on because I'm already depressed in some sense.
Imagine living it.
Yeah, and see, that's just it. I mean, we tend to get we live in very small worlds, and so, you know, we kind of get wrapped around, I get wrapped around my PCA world, and I forget there's other things going on out there that people have it much worse than I think I have it or you know, in those kinds of circumstances. It was so easy just to get closed-minded about that and not realize that there are men who are trying to faithfully labor in circumstances that are extremely hostile.
Yeah, you know, the PCA looks like some pretty green pastures to me. I'll admit that.
See, and I like the way you put that. And so that's a good reminder for us in the PCA that are always crying about what's going on. Hey, it's not pleasant at times, but we're not there yet. But it's a reminder to us that that's where we will be if we're not faithful now to do what we're supposed to do. And it doesn't take long. You know, what is it? Rome wasn't built in a day, but it only takes a day to destroy it. You know, and that's what happens. And so pray for Christ Church, pray for the RCA, and pray that the men of God that have been called to minister in these circumstances would be faithful and not succumb to the pressure because, hey, look, they got families to feed. And there's all kinds of circumstances that are pressure. They're pressure cooker circumstances, and so we as Christ Church just need to be praying for these men and pray for this man who is laboring in Illinois but lives in Indiana. pray for him as he endeavors to be faithful to God's word. And I do, again, thank you for being on to really, I was educated in some sense, and I hope people that listen were as well. If you hang on the line just a minute, I will just wrap things up and then that'll be it for today. As you've noticed, we've been talking with Pastor Ben Coppers about the RCA, the Reformed Church in America, some of the issues, circumstances, concerns. And those of you who are in the OPC, the PCA, maybe another denomination, then you're thinking, man, that sounds terrible. Well, it is. And so before you start bemoaning your own circumstances and your own crisis in your denomination and start realize that there are men, faithful men, in these situations. You're not there yet, fine, but remember these people. And when you're praying for Christ Church, pray for these men who are in these circumstances. If you get nothing else from this discussion today, you ought to have got that by now, because I think I've said it about 10 times. So just be mindful of that circumstance. Coming up on the broadcast, I will be talking with, who am I going to be talking with? I actually don't even know. Oh, wait a minute. I do know. I'll be talking with Amy Bird. She is the author of the book Housewife Theologian. That was a previously scheduled discussion that was pushed off till next week. So next week, you'll be hearing that discussion. It'll be my first female guest on the program. So I look forward to that, especially for all those wives and housewives. I mean, I hate this. Put it that way, but I don't know how else to describe it, who labor at home on a day-to-day basis. The job is harder than you might realize. You know, when I was a young husband and father, I used to think, well, it'd be great to just sit around the house all day. Boy, was I ignorant. But anyway, we'll be talking with her about this book that she has written that is directed towards women, and Housewife Theologian is the title of the book. So look forward to that discussion coming up next week. So until then, I do thank you for listening to this particular edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary, and God bless.